Before this session, I want to, as at the very at the introduction of the whole seminar, I said there are certain ground rules to how we proceed in the seminar, and it's based on Gaudiya Vaishnava principles of philosophical debate, that we're meeting as a sangha and we're going to speak on the level of philosophy and theology, and we're not going to speak on the level of emotionalism or just to be reactive. The ground rules are very clear. So I'm acting as chairperson, even though I'm a man. Not Prabhu, not Nataji, no, person. I also, you know, that the mailman comes to deliver the person. Anyway, can get crazy. But I'm acting in such a capacity. If I feel that things are going to get out of hand, because this is the one session where we could go anywhere, I'm going to, you know, cut in. And if I cut in, the condition of staying here in this debate is that you have to. I'm acting debate. It will become a debate discussion. I don't speak English. Sorry, I'm Irish. What am I doing? I'll use any word. The main function is you know, for us to become Krishna conscious, etc. And there is authority in it, and it has to be respected. So if I ask that, you know, we change the subject or cool down, oh, it has to be done. Okay. Get off. Get off the metaphor. Could have been anywhere. Could have been anywhere. Rasa, I'm talking to you, okay? He's a scapegoat. Okay, so I'm going to pass these out. So there are the ground rules. Well, let's keep it simple. And I'll leave it with Ravindra Swarup Prabhu to give us a presentation here. So everyone, please write their name clearly, legibly. And thank you very much.
Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swaminitya Namane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nirvishesha Shunyavari Paschachade Satarane Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Sri Gaur Bhaktavindam Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna 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 Hare Hare Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. So I've called this Sex, Gender, and the Rectification of Names. That's really a nice obscure title, I thought. That comes from a Chinese philosopher named Kung Fu Tzu, or Confucius. Satchinanda Swami told me I was expected to bring the latest findings from America, but I bring the latest findings from Confucius. They're kind of old. I guess I wanted to start at this place because there's something in ISKCON that's called the woman's issue. I think there's probably the woman's issues. I think there's probably a number of them. There's not one issue. And what the issue is depends on who you are and what country you come from and what your sex is. So I'm not quite sure exactly, you know, what the woman's issue is. But one of the things that we've seen going on in the West is a very strong and powerful woman's liberation or feminist movement. It's at least I can speak in the United States, it's been in many ways quite successful achieving some of its goals. In fact, I find it pretty good in some ways for bringing about more desirable ends. For example, it is now the rule in college campuses that before a man can touch a woman, he has to ask her permission. This is a result of the feminist movement. It is the ground rule in the college campuses in America that if a woman says no, she's supposed to be understood as meaning it. When I grew up, we always understood that when a girl said no, she didn't mean it. So in some ways, this has brought about, I think, an improvement in things. But at any rate, a lot of this there's a lot of ideology and psychology behind it. In religions departments, I've seen women sitting around in committees trying to make up feminist religions. And things like that. They want to get rid of the old patriarchal, phallocentric religions imposed upon them and things like that. And we're trying to preach Krishna consciousness in this atmosphere. And many of the young people that come to us now have been thoroughly trained in this sort of thing. There's this notion, you know, that certain things are sexist. That society in the past was run by men, and they did this by systematically suppressing and oppressing and exploiting women. And as a result of that, practically everything that was produced in the past is suspect. And people are going through, and you see such things as they're rewriting the Bible. That God is described as he, for example, is seen as sexist. So they're trying to get God the parent, God the child. And God, I guess, still is the Holy Spirit. I don't know. But they won't say God the Father. It's God the Parent. Not God the Son. God the Child. And so on like this. And so here we come with Krishna consciousness. And presenting Krishna consciousness. Which, if you read what Prabhupada says, is what people would consider to be, these people would consider to be sexist. Now, of course, the most interesting thing is I don't know anybody in ISKCON, male or female, who knew Srila Prabhupada that thought he was anything like sexist. It simply wasn't there. We could see, everybody could see, that Srila Prabhupada was a liberated soul. He was not on the bodily condition of life. He was not lording it over the material energy. And he was making no judgments of anybody based on false ego. So Srila Prabhupada, there's no way that he was a sexist. But I just want to read you, you know, one of those sort of passages. This is from very esoteric book of Krishna consciousness. This is Bhagavad Gita, you know. And this is written by our founder Acharya. This is in chapter 16, which is describing the demons, as a matter of fact. And it's describing what the demons do. Those who are demoniac do not know what is to be done and what is not to be done. Neither cleanliness nor proper behavior nor truth is found in them. So Prabhupada comments right in this place. He says, As far as for behavior, there are many rules and regulations guiding human behavior, such as the Manusamhita, which is the law of the human race. Now, in the Manusamhita, it is clearly stated that a woman should not be given freedom. This does not mean that women are to be kept as slaves, but they are children. Children are not given freedom, but that does not mean they are kept as slaves. The demons have now neglected such injunctions. And they think that women should be given as much freedom as men. However, this has not improved the social condition of the world. Actually, a woman should be given protection at every stage of life. She should be given protection by the father in her younger days, by the husband in her youth, and by the grown-up sons in her old age. This is proper social behavior according to the Manu Samhita. But modern education has artificially devised the puffed-up concept of womanly life, and therefore marriage is practically now an imagination in human society. Nor is the moral condition of women very good now. The demons, therefore, do not accept any instruction which is good for society, and because they do not follow the experience of great sages and the rules and regulations laid down by the sages, the social condition of the demoniac people is very miserable. So here Prabhupada explicitly attacks the woman's liberation idea and says it's demoniac. And here he puts forward, you know, from that most arch-conservative of all documents, the Manu Samhita, and says this is the standard for human society, and women should not be given freedom. They should be protected by the men at all stages of life, and so on. So what are we to make of this? You know, first of all, if you give Bhagavad Gita class, and there happen to be a lot of young kids in there, you know, you have to be able to explain this. And maybe you have to explain it to ISKCON devotees too, what this means and what we're supposed to make of it. For myself, nowadays what people are doing is they're going through and they're just removing passages like this from books. That's exactly what's going on. I don't think we have that freedom. If there's a parampara, that's how paramparas get destroyed, when people take it on themselves to remove passages from books or to alter them to make them more acceptable for what happens to be the prevalent prejudices of the time. Nor do I think that these kinds of things are in any stretch of the word sexist, because our conviction is that this is Shastra. This is not the product of conditioned souls. This is given to us by liberated souls. And this is the judgment that liberated souls have made. So it is not a product of power relations in society, which is what somebody else, a scholar, somebody looking at this is what they would assume. And I can believe that is simply by knowing Srila Prabhupada, that he would put something like this down in writing, and yet there was never any indication in his life that he had any kind of sexist opinion or sexist judgment or disparaged women or in any way exploited them. So first thing I want to do is just give that's what we have to deal with, right? This is the text. This is the voice of our founder Acharya. This is what's there, and so far as I'm concerned, I don't want to have to change it, nor do I want to just skip it, you know. I only do one thing. Sometimes I only do one thing, actually, I'll confess, is that when I'm reading a passage, a lot of times when Prabhupada means human being or person, he says man. I just change it to person when I'm reading out loud. It just doesn't upset people so much. There's absolutely no change in meaning. And that's what I do, because he is speaking certain kind of English. But other than that, I've never tried to, you know, skip things or make certain things that Prabhupada said, stuff you can't mention. So we have to be able to deal with this. Now, what has to be done to my mind, and to deal with this in my mind, was to try to understand what Srila Prabhupada was saying and trying to understand where this concept of society comes from. The notable thing about the modern feminist or women's liberation movement is the notion behind it all that categories like male and female are essentially human concoctions. Even whatever biological grounding there may be, they don't think is so significant. That's sex. Then above that is what we make of it, which is gender. And that's the important thing, and that's almost always, they say, culturally established. They are made up by human beings. So what is male and what is female? What is husband? What is wife? All these things are human concoctions. And we can be anything that we want to be. English writer Virginia Woolf predicted at the early part of this century that she thought that the whole human race was moving toward androgyny, that gradually the differences between the sexes were, in the course of time, going to disappear. That was her particular observation, and maybe it's true or not. It's true. I got this piece of information from Confucius here. I want to read it to you just to show you, give you an idea. It states really our position, but it's a nice statement by this Feng Yulan, this professor, talking about a program that Confucius wanted to carry out, which Confucius called the rectification of names. Let me go through it, and then we'll try to apply it. In regard to society, Confucius held that in order to have a well-ordered one, the most important thing is to carry out what he called the rectification of names. That is, things in actual fact should be made to accord with the implication attached to them by names. Once a disciple asked him what he would do first if he were to rule a state, whereupon Confucius replied, "The one thing needed first is the rectification of names." On another occasion, one of the dukes of the time asked Confucius the right principle of government, to which he answered, "Let the ruler be ruler." What's my place? The minister, minister. The father, father. And the son, son. So that sounds a little inscrutable. So here it's explained. In other words, every name contains certain implications which constitute the essence of that class of things to which the name applies. Such things, therefore, should agree with this ideal essence. The essence of a ruler is what the ruler ideally ought to be, or what in Chinese is called the way of the ruler. If a ruler acts according to this way of the ruler, he is then truly a ruler in fact as well as in name. There is agreement between name and actuality. But if he does not, he is no ruler, even though he may be popularly regarded as such. Every name in the social relationships implies certain responsibilities and duties. Ruler, minister, father, and son are all the names of such social relationships, and the individuals bearing these names must fulfill their responsibilities and duties accordingly. Such is the implication of Confucius' theory of the rectification of names. So I think that we have the same idea when we talk about Varnashram Dharma, for example. There is society, the listing of 8 different positions, and Krishna says they are created by me. Well, there he mentions 4, Chaturvarnam. They are created by me. That form of human society is not a human concoction. I mentioned earlier, it's normative. It's laid down by Krishna. What a Brahmana is, what a Kshatriya is, what a Vaishya is, what a Shudra is, Brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyas, husband, wife, man, woman, all these things, I think you can go on and talk about all the roles and positions, are in fact eternally set forth. Here he uses the notion of essences. When you have a word, there's an essence. There's like the Platonic ideal type. Now, Plato and Confucius, they were somewhat like contemporaries. But you see, this is generally a very widespread ancient way of looking at things, that the way things are is somehow or other established by divinity or divine power. And so these terms, male and female, and various social relationships attached to them, are not concoctions that we are at liberty to mess around with. That's our basic philosophy. I mean, we are so far to the right, it's almost inconceivable to modern people that we actually accepted that these things are handed down by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That he's decided what it means, what the position is, what the essence is to be a male, to be a female, to be old, I mean, to be a Brahmana, to be a Kshatriya, all these different things. That's our thing. And therefore, when we talk about, say, establishing Varnashram Dharma, it is in fact just exactly this rectification of names program that Confucius was talking about. So when we come to the position and the role of women, we can understand that that also is not something with which we can concoct. We are supposed to follow the Dharma. And if we actually look at things, we discover, in fact, that we don't have the liberty to change he to she when referring to divinity. In fact, she's already there. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati somewhere remarks, he says, some people worship a he god, some people worship a she god, and some people worship an it god, but God is he, she, and it. So everything is there. So there's Krishna, the eternal male, and there's Radha, the eternal female. Both are there. So these ideas, masculinity and femininity, are there in transcendence. What's behind them that says they're all concoctions is precisely Mayavada philosophy. That's precisely what it is. Or that we can go around painting any face we want on transcendence. Oh, I don't like this male god, I'm going to wipe it out and make a female god. Because behind it's the idea that anyway, it's our concoction anyway, we can concoct any god we want. And we can concoct any human society we want. We can make ourselves in the way that we want to be. This is modern thinking. The older idea, the idea that was prevalent up until the time of the Renaissance, is that we have natures in the play by Shakespeare, Othello. In all of Shakespeare's plays, the tragedies, the villains always speak modern philosophy. Shakespeare was a conservative, and he didn't really like the Renaissance so much. And so it's the villains that speak modern philosophy. People today have trouble because they can't understand why what's so bad with the villains, because they speak what everybody knows is true, but to Shakespeare it was quite wrong. So in that play there's a Othello, the villain is Iago, and there's one fellow wants to do something, Rodriguez, and Iago wants him to save money or something, some trivial discussion, and Rodriguez said, well, it's not my virtue. By virtue he meant nature. It's not my nature. And Iago says, virtue, a fig. It is in our wills that we are what we are. If we want to be, you know, and he goes on and makes a big speech that we can become and be anything we want to be. And to say that something is your nature that you can't change is just out the window. So to Shakespeare, this was the speech of a diabolical person. So here we've got this essentially very old philosophy, which says that these things are handed down. What is in this case we're dealing with women. So what is a man and what is a woman? And we see also in transcendence, we've got masculinity and femininity, and those are eternal values. So you see they're described in this way. There's the enjoyer, masculine. There's the enjoyed, feminine. These things are described in this way. So if we really, you know, you want to change everything, you have to wipe out a lot of Krishna consciousness, including Radha and Krishna, and who they are in their relationship together. Now, of course, the other argument is, well, those are all human projections of certain social relationships onto the divine and all that other stuff. Well, if you want to be a Mayavad, you can accept that also. That's what the alternative is. But so far as I can see, these things, male and female, and the social position of women, the structure of women, this is handed down to us by unimpeachable authorities. Prabhupada Bhagavatam calls unimpeachable authorities. They've laid down this path, and anybody who tries to concoct their own ways and means, they fail again and again. This is what Srimad Bhagavatam says. So, having said all that, I now want to say that I don't think we've come anywhere close to understanding what the unimpeachable authorities want. In ISKCON, to speak of outside of ISKCON, and that's, I think, is the actual challenge. There's a very good reason why there's a women's liberation movement or a feminist movement in the West. An excellent reason. Because they started out with the position that the women were supposed to be protected by the men. And then everybody started to realize, well, who's going to protect me from my protectors? That this protection, the so-called protection, turned out to be massive, overwhelming exploitation for sense gratification. And that as as time went on and things got worse and worse, women found themselves in an absolutely intolerable position. And it's completely understandable why there should be some kind of reaction like that. Because simply there was no such thing as protection. And people began to understand, I have to take care of myself. I have to watch out for myself. I can't be exploited like this. So there's a very good reason for it. And I would say that most people growing up in the West, in Karmi society, have been exposed to very degenerate forms of human relationships. And when the Bhagavad Gita or the Bhagavatam talk about the role of women and the role of men, they talk about Varnashram Dharma, we actually have no idea of what they're talking about in our experience. And when somebody reads that women should be protected by men, immediately one can think of, you know, some, what does this mean? What is it like? We don't need protection like that, because the experience has been in recent social history so horrible, and such an experience of oppression as far back as actually maybe history goes. This is what they've been seeing. So Prabhupada has outlined an ideal society for us, a society which is supposedly ruled by brahmanas, which is based on transcendence. It's something people have gotten rid of a long time ago. You know, like we believe in the divine right of kings. I mean, that's also rather conservative philosophy, you know. And you say to people, we should bring kings back, and immediately they think, you know, Mad Ludwig of Bavaria and all these people, that we don't want kings, you know. So this, at any rate, is what I would like to say is that people have to be shown that we have to take it in this society, both men and women, that this notion that women should be protected by men, and that certain social relationships are prescribed in this way, we should take them seriously. I think things have gone wrong in our society on a number of occasions because women have been asked to fulfill the traditional role of women, but men have not really taken the responsibility that's supposed to go along with it. And again, have taken over domineering, controlling, exploiting attitudes which they are supposed to become, be free from. And that's why some places in our society there's also what people think is a woman's liberation movement. Because in our society, a number of women have said, well, I've been protected and I don't want it anymore. And you actually sit down and listen to people's histories and you what are you going to do? You can't blame them for that kind of protection. So, nevertheless, this is the Prabhupada throughout his literature, throughout his books, he says that women should not be given freedom, they should be protected by men. And I think there are very, very good reasons for that. One thing is, in thinking about this, there's some very positive values. As I said, we see that for human culture to develop, sometimes it's better for people to specialize. And there's certain positive values that are realized in what we call masculinity. And there are certain other very positive and necessary values which are realized in what we call femininity. Now, it is so arranged by the Lord that the best people to cultivate masculinity are, in fact, men. And the best people to cultivate femininity are women. And the Vedic system actually allows for those values, by a division of labor, allows for those values to develop in full. So I'm sure that many women can look after themselves. I'm sure they can protect themselves as well as any men. I know that there are many women who are able to go to karate studios and can put any man on the floor in 2 minutes. So a woman can learn to become very adept even at physical self-defense. I have no doubt about that. There's systems when it works. You know, if you put them in a boxing ring with a heavyweight, then there's a disadvantage. But then there are other ways. And of course, the gun is the great equalizer. So modern weapons is especially brought immense firepower into the control of the weaker sex. But if women do that, then certain things will not develop. Certain ability to nurture, to care for, those things we associate as the special realm of women. They're the best ones to specialize in that. And if women are actually protected, and they don't have to worry about what's coming up behind my back or carrying a gun on their hip like the cowboys or something, then that can those values of femininity can actually develop. And if men are the protectors, then those values of masculinity can actually develop. But men have to learn. When Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, he says, "You surrender to me." He then says, "I will protect you." Whenever Krishna, you want to surrender to somebody, surrender, you have to be confident before you surrender that person can actually take care of you. And that always goes on. So there's always that reciprocation. Krishna approves to Arjuna, in fact, that he's in charge of everything and is running everything and taking care of everything. And if he comes into shelter, comes to take shelter of him, Krishna is really going to be able to give him all protection. He says, "You don't have to worry. I'll be your career manager. You just serve me, and I'll take care of you better than you can take care of yourself." And this idea, of course, everyone in surrendering to Krishna for protection takes a feminine position in relationship to the masculine Krishna. In a way, the most universal value for living entities is femininity, because we're all prakriti and Krishna is the only Purusha around. So instituted in the material world, and women are supposed to surrender to men, they also have to be able to protect and take care of and not exploit. That has to go on. And as I said before, I think in our movement there's been something of a widespread failure to take this very seriously as a responsibility. So that women have been asked to surrender and then have not been given adequate protection. Now, I'm going to make a few more remarks. I talked about this conservative system and the traditional role of women. So, of course, what we have in ISKCON, and what makes things especially confusing, is we've got two systems. When you start talking about the traditional role of women, now we're really dealing in the realm of Varnashram. And where people work and take social roles according to their psycho physical nature. So that's the Varnashram Dharma side. And I say we're not really free to change that. It's handed down by Krishna. And our really business is to learn it. We haven't come close to realizing it yet. And we don't even know what it means, the kind of society that Krishna is talking about. But the other side, I guess we'll call Bhagavad Dharma, Bhagavad Dharma doesn't deal with the bodily condition of life. In Bhagavad Dharma, there are no men, there are no women. Everyone is Vaishnava and a spirit soul. They're all on the same platform, equal. That's the other Dharma that we've had. And there's a lot of confusion in this con because we don't really know how these two should be knit together. So there's all these really, you know, conservative right-wing quotations about women that are all under, they usually come under this Varnashram Dharma side. And there's a whole set, because people are always really good at pulling out quotes. You can you know, hit your database, and you can put all other quotations about women as being as good as men, better than men, and so on, same as men, shouldn't see any difference. All this is in the Bhagavad Dharma context, and those are there too. And we see in that position that we're not supposed to make any kind of differentiation. And we see that while Prabhupada very rigorously upholds Varnashram Dharma, and Krishna very rigorously upholds Varnashram Dharma, still the Vaishnava tradition has always been a little revolutionary. Because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, when he talks about the women, Vaishya, Shudras, they can attain the supreme destination. That's like a really revolutionary thing to say. It's not just the exclusive business of saintly kings and brahmanas anymore. Anybody can go to Krishna. Plus, we have the instances in Srimad Bhagavatam of women who give brilliant prayers with great realization and whose actually words become scripture, like Kunti and Devahuti. And we also have, in our own Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, women spiritual masters. The name of Ganga Mata Goswamini is on our list of appearance days to observe. What to speak of Janavi Devi and there are some more. Well, these women actually became gurus in the Krishna because of their advancement in Krishna consciousness. So part of the confusion arises. Over we're doing these kind of two things at once. And there's a bit of a history in this con, I think. Because it seems to me, anyway, as I see the past in this con, that when Prabhupada came to the West, he just adopted pretty well to what was going on. When I moved in the temple, actually, men and women just danced mixed up all together. We didn't even have, besides the room or anything. In fact, we called the women gopis. That's right, they were called gopis, you know. That changed later on, you know. I don't know where it came from. there's a story that's told, you know, that in the beginning when Prabhupada came, women did very many things. Also, you see old pictures of Prabhupada. He's always surrounded by women in the early days. Everywhere you go, there are women right up front, you know. Then later pictures, you know, you don't see any women. You see Prabhupada, a wall of dandas. And there's no women anywhere to be seen. Like someone shoved out of the way by the rise of the sannyasis or something, you know. So part of the issue, and I guess it's an issue in which I'm... Oh, well, part of the question has been, Brennan, what really happened? Why did this happen? Did it really happen? One version is... I've heard two different versions. One version is that Prabhupada came, and he was very liberal, and he said very liberal things about women, and wanted them to be engaged in any kind of affairs, and so on. But that later, with the rise of sannyasis, and also devotees going to India, much more conservative sorts of social policies reflected on people's experiences in India became standard in ISKCON. Women kind of being put out of sight, going to the back of the temple room, not giving classes, not giving public lectures. These kinds of things were happening on, and they say, you know, this is because of this Indian influence, maybe pushed by the rise of a lot of sannyasis. The answer I've heard to this is that Prabhupada wanted this to happen. He wanted us to learn from India how to do things, how to run our social relationships. And it wasn't something that was sort of happened without Prabhupada's knowledge, but that actually this is what he wanted to happen. That's the other side of the story. As far as the history goes, at this point I'm not quite sure what the truth is. I guess you could spend a lot of time delving into it and finding it out. But it does seem that as our movement began, you know, also Prabhupada had an early thing, and in early parts of his books, he says, we do not need Varnashram Dharma. He says, it's not possible in Kali Yuga. And then he changed his mind. And later on, he became to emphasize more and more Varnashram Dharma. His original intention was to bring everybody to this platform. He said, I remember a lecture, he said, this Varnashram Dharma, he said, see, we have already become devotees of Krishna, and we don't have had the Varnashram Dharma. So it is not necessary. But then that confident statement that we have already become devotees of Krishna seemed to be modified a little bit. And that therefore Prabhupada, our original intention was to, as far as possible, establish everybody on this Bhagavad Dharma platform, which is really the platform of liberated souls. We are supposed to follow Varnashram Dharma until we are entirely free from the bodily concept of life. So this is really a platform of liberated souls. Now, everywhere Prabhupada says, a Vaishnava is a liberated soul. He's better than a Brahmana. Brahmana is in the mode of goodness. Better than that has to be liberated. So the Vaishnavas are everywhere liberated souls. not always, it seems. In every case, is that a fact? We see that some people have turned out not to be so liberated. Although my own conviction is that if you have a Vaishnava who is strictly following all the principles, that is a liberated soul for all practical purposes. Prabhupada says this may not actually be liberated because there still may be material desires in the heart and so on. But if that person is strictly following, then he's acting just like a liberated soul. Maharaj and I were talking about this at lunchtime. But anyway, this Bhagavad Dharma is for liberated souls. And Varnashram Dharma, up until that time, we are supposed to strictly follow. So now in our movement, there's this attempt to institute Varnashram Dharma more. And whenever you do that, that's when the position of women comes up in this Varnashram Dharma system, which is the very, you know, traditional, homebound, child-rearing, servant of the husband sort of position that comes up. But the Bhagavad Dharma is still there. And so I guess I want to open this up for discussion. This is not very systematic presentation. These are just various thoughts that I've had on the topic. But I want to give you a few more thoughts, and then we'll open this up for discussion, because I'm sure everybody else has had lots of thoughts on this topic. To adjudicate properly between these two, it seems to me, my own experience, is not really something that can be done on a theoretical platform. It's really a practical matter. How it should work out. And practice means to me that I'm not going. I do not wish to dispute any of the statements that Srila Prabhupada made about the position of women. There are other things that he said. When he was in Philadelphia, in fact, I heard him in 1975. He had just been in Chicago, where he had got into a confrontation with a woman reporter, in which he reported that women were less intelligent because their brains were certifiably smaller. And this got in the newspapers, and there was a whole big uproar. Something Prabhupada had read in a physiology book he had in college, you know, 19th century physiology. It wasn't Shastra. So he was in Philadelphia, and again the subject came up with a woman reporter, and there was some discussion about that. In fact, it was very, very funny, but what Prabhupada did, it was so... the woman was all... She was arguing for woman's liberation, and Prabhupada said, your position is that you are dependent. He said, suppose you become independent and a man enjoys you and you become pregnant. He said, then what is your position? Either you can kill your own child, or you have to go beg from the government. So your position... is dependent. Is that a good choice, to either become dependent on the government or to kill your own child? And the woman said something like, well, at least it's her choice. And Prabhupada said, that's 32 ounces. he was so fast. He was almost under his breath, you know. It was so fast. He was really funny. So he didn't think that she was very smart. So after this thing and the woman left, you know, there were some women there who were a little distressed, understandably, by this conversation. And so I was standing right there, and Vishaka and some other ladies were talking to Prabhupada. And she said, is it true that we're really less intelligent? Prabhupada said, oh no, he said. When a woman becomes a devotee, her brain grows. And that's what he said. So I you know, on this subject, I don't think it's a good idea to be very doctrinaire and just accept people for what they are, you know. What I think our movement has to do, as far as management goes, is to make arrangement for every individual, irrespective of social position or sex, to make as much spiritual advancement as possible. There has to be equal access, everybody, to the means of spiritual advancement. It's unconscionable to deprive somebody of the ability to make spiritual advancement. And so certain things are needed, like, for example, a place to chant japa. Ability to see the deities. Ability to engage in service to the full extent of your capacity. And everybody needs to do that. And if someone is in a female body and has some great capacity for a certain kind of service, you know, if that person is stopped from discharging that service just because she happens to be in a female body, then, you know, somebody is standing in the way of that person's spiritual advancement.
And so that much seems to me that has just everyone has to have that opportunity for spiritual advancement. That's why, like, for example, when this issue comes up in several places and came up in front of the GBC even, about women giving Srimad Bhagavatam classes. And it just seemed to me, on those grounds, that for me, the ability to give classes, the ability means like the possibility of doing so, being allowed to give classes, has made me learn Prabhupada's books and the philosophy more than anything else. If it was somehow or other I was not able to ever give a class, I'm sure I wouldn't, because if you want, you know, you don't really learn something until you have to teach it. That's my experience. So to say in principle a whole group of people can't give class is to really deprive them of something to me that was very, very important in spiritual life. So just for on that ground alone, it was never an issue of, you know, somebody has these quotes and somebody else has those quotes, you know, and you count the quotes up and see who wins or something like that, you know. Or you take a vote in the community, and if there are more men, you know, they don't, and if there are more women, they do, or whatever. But just on those grounds alone, that's my particular judgment on that. That everyone has to have the means for spiritual advancement as far as possible. It may be, in fact, it is, more difficult. A woman's body is a more difficult position for spiritual advancement. That I can understand that. My wife tells me all the time. And I believe her. So I know that's a fact. But that doesn't mean that all of a sudden I make it more difficult. Actually, one should make it easier for women to make spiritual advancement if there's any other if there are other impediments and difficulties. So I think in my own judgment, if that principle is followed, then I think we'll make we'll just see how things, you know, fall out. That if the women are just given as much as all men are given the opportunity to make as much spiritual advancement as possible, that when you can increase your service, you should increase your service. And one should always be increasing one's service. And one should do the service that suits one's own disposition and nature and propensities. To my mind, that's the more practical way to kind of sort out this kind of relationship, because I can't figure it out in my head at all, quite frankly, how these two will fit together. In our Krishna consciousness movement. Okay, I think I've stopped with my observations. And let's hear it from the representative from Ireland.
I have two questions, and I'll keep them brief. One is, in your final analysis, you definitely fell on the Bhagavad Dharma side of the blackboard. In terms of your judgment of your analysis was that, you know, facility has to be given to the spirit soul to practice spiritual life. Black, white, man, woman, mm-hmm. These aren't mm-hmm. our considerations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it did, huh? Okay.
Because that's where I personally feel I can relate to the mm-hmm. subject. And I just want to. And another analysis that I would like you to comment on. Jonathan Swift, who wrote Gulliver's Travels, he...
a great Irish author, right?
Great Irish author. I hardly know Irish. But he wrote, it was a satire on modern society, not a children's story. And he was so upset that it wasn't taken as a satire, mm-hmm. but everyone took it as a children's story. So he wrote to Alexander Pope explaining this. And he said in the letter that it's amazing how when you satire someone, they never recognize themselves. They always think it's somebody else you're talking about, mm-hmm. and they agree with the point. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, you know, when you made your analysis, there's nobody who would, in essence, in theology, philosophy disagree with the conclusion, the basic non-sectarian mm-hmm. principle of Bhagavad Dharma. So who is it that's responsible for the situation? You know, when you try and pin it down, or when you try and evoke change, you talk mm-hmm. about women at the side of the temple, and you talk about women giving class, mm-hmm. but these things effectively aren't happening in our society. Mm-hmm. Where does the book stop? Because everybody kind of shakes their head and says, well, I think that's a good analysis. I agree with, you know. How would you, am I putting you on the spot there? But I mean, that's just an analysis that I just thought of when you were saying that.
Well, I don't know. I want to hear maybe somebody else has some answers to this question. You know, if somebody wants to reply to that one, where do they think the problem is? Or is it coming from? Or is there a problem? Some people, I guess, maybe they think there's no problem.
Some of the ladies, and I've noticed that as kind of adjudicating, that a lot of the speakers don't look at the ladies for mm-hmm. questions. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, it's not to do with this class, just has mm-hmm. to be. So,
why don't we make it fair? So somebody has to run back and forth. She should have had two mics.
Because I have a mixed answer on the question. So uh-huh. maybe who takes responsibility for the mm-hmm. situation? My question is, isn't this a problem of offense? This behavior of the man? So this is a little bit offense. It's the first offense against Vaishnava sometimes, mm-hmm. this rough behavior and so. And I think the leader, the gurus or the sannyasis and all this, they have to take responsibility to preach to the devotees, not only to the men, to every devotee, to understand mm-hmm. this point. And I think only this, we have no chance. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, this preaching in the Brahmachari ashram will not end. Mm-hmm. We cannot change this. Nobody mm-hmm. can change this. Only the leader can change this. Mm-hmm. And whatever a great person does or say, the person will follow.
Now, see, I'm a little at sea because I'm in a different country. And I don't know what preaching goes on here in the Brahmachari ashrams. In America, we don't have any Brahmachari ashrams. No, that's not true yet. I know you all think that, but it's not true yet. So, I mean, there's a feeling. I mean, when I say is the feeling... Is your opinion is that actually men and women don't have the same opportunity for spiritual advancement? Don't have. Or do you think that they have the same or not?
No, we don't have. Maybe in real we have. Krishna gives us the same.
Well,
we have different situations. But I think it is very important for the men not to make so much offense. We have not the problem.
Yeah.
Our situation is okay. We have to suffer.
I see.
You see? We have to suffer like the cow in the slaughterhouse. This is a previous sinful activities.
Uh-huh.
But the men have to suffer in the future.
Uh-huh.
So we can help them when we say, please don't make this. This is your future you create now. So in this uh-huh. offense also destroy the...
Well, what in your mind is the offense that's being committed in particular?
Mm-hmm.
What would you say? Just women are being blasphemed or...
Oh, offense? Oh, not to have a nice behavior to a Vaishnava.
Ah.
So we have so many. What can I say?
I mean, just bad behavior.
Bad behavior, yes.
Oh, you know, come on. You know, guys, come on. Well, part of this business of protecting women is to be chivalrous, which really means good behavior. You can still, you know, be a man and protect women without being rude and nasty. Prabhupada said, you know, that you're supposed to regard every woman, except for your wife, as your mother. Unfortunately, the way most people regard their own mothers in the West is not very... not very high, so this people don't know this standard either, how you're supposed to treat your mother, so you have to go back to the standard of treating your mother.
but it's a fact that people that are unprotected, or people who are relying on protection, women, children, old people, the people, you really have to go out of your way. And I noticed that, like, for example, I noticed that we would have Harinam parties. The men would be in the front and the women would be in the back. And because the women are in the back, drunks would come out the bar and grab them, you know. And it was a big deal to say, you know, you shouldn't put the women in the back. There should be at least some men behind the women to protect them. And I couldn't understand. I mean, what has this got to do with any philosophy? It's just a simple thing, you know. But somehow or other, everybody's going to go out in Harinam. The women were going to go in the back, and nobody thought that they had to look after them. And it was a little dangerous. So I couldn't understand the mentality that would just not take care like that. So I could understand when the women either wouldn't want to go out in Harinam or wanted to go in front or something like that, then everybody gets really upset. Why? But it was a very simple thing. So there should be in the Brahmachari Ashram some teachings in this matter about how to treat women with respect and with courtesy. I think you know that shouldn't be like that shouldn't be a philosophical issue for anybody. That should be just a practical matter of human decency. So let's hear it from the renowned daughter of life here. Huh? Give it to Maharaj.
I think we will soon have a very interesting discussion, but before that. it would be nice to get some just the last set of definitions clear. Since you put so much emphasis, even in the title of this seminar, on the rectification of names, I would like to ask you to clarify two points which you made. You said, the masculinity in men are developed, these qualities which and desirable qualities of the male prototype, so to say, are developed if men are protectors, and the same with women, their feminine qualities are developing nicely, these good qualities, when they are nicely protected. And you went on to say that nowadays everything is so debased, mm-hmm. that we have no ideas what are these good qualities of masculinity and femality or femininity. Could you maybe talk on this, so then we... I think this is very important because for definition reasons, then we can maybe be more enlightened in talk than on this basis.
Well, it's I think that the qualities I'm talking about are sometimes traditionally decided as being masculine or femininity. Men are supposed to be bold, aggressive, adventurous, controllers, in that way, and develop, you know, depending on their ashram, the qualities will develop differently. Heroism, determination, other kind of kshatriya qualities, and so on. Femininity, the qualities we see in femininity that are very much needed and work well in society is when women are protected, then they can afford to be tender, soft, caring, nurturing, like that. Shy. The shy quality is there. Yeah, shy. Somebody's got some other ideas? Chaste. Yeah. So this is but when I mean to say we really don't know what they mean, is that at least in what I've seen in America, you know, there's been like this incredible kind of sexual warfare going on, and almost everybody in America is a casualty in one way or another, you know. Wounded in their masculinity, wounded in their femininity, deep-seated hatreds and resentments of the opposite sex, who are also the objects of desire, which makes it a very difficult situation. And so that when people come to the Hare Krishna movement, you know, they already have in their head so many horrible things, you know. So people have become already women haters, men haters. And that's also because even in parenthood, what they see as their mothers and what they see as their fathers has been so terrible. You know, who sets role models of what it is to be a male and what it is to be a female has already so much fallen apart. And people are growing up, so many percentage of the people are growing up in single family single-parent houses. So I just mean to say, you have to take the whole thing and kind of do it all together. You can't expect women to take a traditional position and lay it all on women to be like this without also saying to the men to do their side of the thing. I think in ISKCON it's tended to be a little one-sided, and that's been part of the problem. When Prabhupada says that women should be protected, what that protection is, nobody wants to have anything to do with, because we were protected once before, we saw what it was like, and no thanks. But in a Vedic civilization, where men are actually men and do what men are supposed to do, then women will actually be protected and not exploited. But in our experience, there's always this element of exploitation, because the enjoying attitude is already there. At least I've heard some women who at least come to ISKCON from outside, they feel immediate relief for being in ISKCON because they're not so much conscious all of a sudden of being the sex object. You know, this is a big thing in the outside feminist movement, you know, to stop thinking of us as sex objects. Of course, they still have the skirts up to here, you know. And one has seen, at least when I was in the university, the awkward position of women sort of demanding you not look at them as sex objects, while at the same time with their bodies, in fact, giving just the opposite message. So some very nasty transactions were going on there. But I can see why it is, part of the degradation of women has been systematically degrade them by thinking of them as simply as sex objects. So the potential is there that in the Krishna conscious movement they can be freed from that particular form of degradation. There's even a new book out in the United States, by the way, which is a feminist vegetarian book, and it shows on the front cover a poster that was displayed in butcher shops, which had the naked body of a woman, like they do with cow's body, you know, rump, loin, breast, you know, marked off with the various cuts of meat, and was tying together exploitations of animals and exploitation of women. So that was some poster that, you know, can you imagine a butcher has this poster in their shop? It's just unbelievable. But that's the kind of thing that's going on. So anyway, that's as much as I can say about that left for right now. Some of the ideas of what these values are, we can learn from reading Mahabharata, where you can see in action the qualities that some people had, both men and women, and exhibit them in different ways. That's also there. Okay?
I have a question to Varnashram Dharma.
Uh-huh.
Because we hear from the scriptures like Mother Sita and so many great women who get the path of became perfected because they followed their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
But as I understand from when Prabhupada came to America, he didn't expect the women to like this, but he brought more the Bhagavad Dharma. So it's a little bit controversial to me. I don't understand which path now, because in the beginning one may be attracted only to the Bhagavad Dharma because of not understanding these things in Varnashram Dharma, that it's very difficult to understand, I think, that one has a role to act and at the same time not to identify with this. And also, also the difference is that we also have the spiritual master, which is expecting from us certain services which were not there in Vedic times.
Yeah, I understand your question. Of course, in a general way, this was confusing to me. I joined the movement. The first thing I learned is I'm not my body. And then I learned a whole new set of bodily designations that were completely unfamiliar. Brahmachari, Grihastha, and so on. Which was very confusing at first. If we're not my body, why do I have to learn these bodily designations rather than some others, you know? So it's a similar sort of thing. It is, and you hear statements on both sides. I mean, Prabhupada did... if a woman works as a husband's assistant and she shares in his spiritual advancement, then in principle there's no need for the woman to become initiated and so on. She just has to assist her husband and then he makes spiritual advancement and she makes spiritual advancement. And this is kind of a traditional Varnashram Dharma way of looking at things. And Prabhupada not only gave women initiation, but he formed this Brahmacharini ashram, which was an expedient, you know. From what I understand, at first he thought he would just make male disciples, but then there were so many women coming, and you had to give Lord Chaitanya's mercy to everybody. They didn't have husbands, they didn't have fathers, they were just sort of out like everybody else, So that's what Prabhupada did, thinking of himself as being extremely radical. You know, when Allen Ginsberg complained to Prabhupada that he was very conservative, Prabhupada was really surprised because Prabhupada thought he was doing all these incredibly radical things, and Allen Ginsberg thought he was conservative. So Prabhupada departed in for practical reasons from this traditional role. And so far as I can understand is that as women are initiated in this movement and have gurus, it's a kind of a fail-safe system. If they don't make any spiritual advancement on their own, they still get their husband's spiritual advancement. And... if they don't make any spiritual advancement, and their husband does, they get that too. And if it works the other way around, if the woman more is advanced than the husband, I don't know if the husband gets a share in that or not. Somebody will have to see, but that's the position is conceivable in Krishna consciousness. I think it's been seen now and then even. I don't know exactly what, you know, both of them are there. If there's a conflict, I can't tell you in principle how to settle it. What to do. If the guru says one thing and the husband says something else, then you got a real problem on your hands. Well, it's a problem. And yeah. You should consult with some other people who know the particulars and get some idea what to do.
I have another question in concern of protection of women.
Mm-hmm.
Because is it not that it is for the husband to protect, also the husband, the father, and the son? But what about then brahmacharinis? They don't have anything.
No, they're supposed to be protected by the temple president and temple authorities.
Yeah, but he cannot be the husband of every...
No, he should not be the husband. I don't know who's preaching that philosophy. Think of him as a father rather than as a husband. The temple president should protect the brahmacharinis in the temple like daughters. That's the way. But that's who's supposed to be protecting. And as I said, I think there's been a lot of experience where that hasn't... people are busy with other things and just kind of neglected and ignored the women. Expected them to produce so much service, but not really seeing if they're being, you know, even physically taken care of very well. And all I can do as a man is apologize to you that that's happened. But it's certainly, and that's just a deviation from Krishna consciousness. It has nothing to do with any philosophy of Krishna consciousness. It's just simply material contamination. Well, I think there was one more question.
I want to talk about the spiritual woman, or the woman that is development in the spiritual way. I believe that one of the main problems between man and woman is that they forget that they are always servants. When we forget that we are servants, then we say, you are pushing me, you are making me problems, or in another way. Also the man, sometimes he believes he's Krishna. So one of the best problems is the moment that we forget that we are servants. And the way that we are going to develop our spiritual advance, it will solve these problems. And the man won't have afraid from the woman, because sometimes they are afraid because they are not sure. And the way they develop their spiritual life, they will be sure and they won't be more problems.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I mean, it is a fact that Krishna consciousness is the cure for everything. That's true. You over here? Do you need the microphone this side now? We have to give them a chance.
There are a couple of things. Do we understand correctly that this protection of women principle is accepted? Because you were reading this of Srila Prabhupada.
Mm-hmm.
So
I accept it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to.
Yeah. This may sound also like a stupid question. It probably is, but then if a lady should be protected throughout her whole life, mm-hmm. that does that imply that she can never take sannyas?
You're supposed to have a son who takes care of her when you take sannyas. The GBC has now made it a regulation, you know, that a man who's married cannot take sannyas unless he can show that his wife is being taken care of economically.
Sorry, I was meaning
that she can't take sannyas.
That the lady cannot take sannyas.
Yeah,
she can't do that.
Yeah, that's right.
So then that brings me into another point, because in this movement there is a great need of a standard, like a very high spiritual standard, and that standard, as far as I see, is set by a certain group of people, mainly the sannyasis. Mm-hmm. So that kind of leads me into the question of protection of the sannyasis.
Mm-hmm.
And because you were mentioning that everyone should get equal access to the means for spiritual advancement, so to me it seems it has to somehow or another involve some kind of compromise.
What do you mean, protection of the sannyasis?
Yeah, no, I mean...
What's that got to do with compromise? I don't know, I lost you there somewhere.
Well,
sannyasis are protected directly by Krishna. Right? They depend completely on Krishna.
Yes.
They're homeless people, they don't know where their next meal is coming from, but still, Krishna protects.
I was meaning basically for practical purposes, because to bring it back in history and getting a little bit fundamentalistic here, when I was new Bhakta, I was taught the old butter and fire principle, and the mm-hmm. explanation was given that, I could understand it, because honestly speaking, there are quite a few of the ladies who are like, beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that...
Yeah, that's one of the opulences of the Hare Krishna movement.
Yeah. So to me, in a sense, properly carried out...
Good-looking men, too.
Properly carried out, the principle of, separating men and women, I could accept of that fact, because...
Yeah, right.
One of the explanations were given to me why we shave the head and the physique and the strange clothes is that, men, they don't look so attractive in the eyes of women, so they can stand in the front or, to the side or this and that. So these things I kind of accepted on the basis of the statement of the butter and fire thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just seeing the implications. If we would have, like this, every second day there is some lady, beautiful, maybe self-realized, whatever, giving the Bhagavatam class, and then the Swami should sit, or Brahmacharis, whatever, and listen. I don't know, some kind of compromise seems to hang there in the air, so to speak. I don't know if I'm too mm-hmm. macho or something.
Yeah, sometimes that objection is given. One temple, they told me, they don't mind if certain women give class, those that are over 40, and things like that. But they find it very hard to handle if the woman is young and good-looking and giving class. I've heard that. But I can understand it, too, actually. I have to say I can understand it. On the other hand, it is not a fact that while men find women sexually attractive, that it doesn't work the other way around. There was, in fact, an interesting book, interesting book on the Hare Krishna movement called The Strange World of the Hare Krishnas. It came out as a paperback in America. And the author, a woman, went and stayed in the New York temple for a while. In fact, Bali Mardan was the president. And she tells in the book how she fell in love with him. And she talked about how great-looking the men were in dhotis. And how sometimes you could see their legs when they walked, So there, we shave our heads and wear, dhotis and stuff like that. At least Faye Levine found it very attractive anyway. So I don't know, this part about, this men say, I'll get very agitated if I have to look at a young, pretty woman giving Bhagavatam class. But I think the women are expected to sit and let, a young, handsome man give class. And somehow or other, it doesn't bother them, or maybe it does, I don't know. But if it does, it's not important. So I don't quite understand why it's not supposed to bother them, but it's supposed to bother men. I mean, maybe men are just more, more melting. I don't know. Does anybody want to comment on this topic over on this side here?
I don't want to comment, but
Interesting.
I have an argument that people give, and they say that, well, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it says that the body of a woman is well designed to run the world in illusion, and the body of a man is not so attractive. So that's one argument some people give. So what would you answer?
No, Prabhupada says that a man is attractive too. He says they have long arms like snakes. Somewhere that, then the woman likes to be embraced by those long arms. It's admitted there in some places. You know. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to be objective in this subject matter. Anyone else over here want to talk about this particular question? Or we want to go on to something else? I'm afraid you may be... Okay, go ahead. Whatever you want. So the people in the back are not getting a chance, too. Maybe we should do that. Huh? The ladies in the back.
We've been operating along the lines of ladies not giving class for a long time, and there's still a lot of fall downs, you know. And it seems.
You said there's still a lot of fall downs, even though there might be more, I don't know.
And it seems to me that if the men cultivate an attitude towards women that they're stupid, that they're you know, less intelligent, that they cannot make spiritual advancement, therefore. There's simply the conclusion from that is that they're good for nothing but to be exploited for my sense gratification. But if the men in our movement see that the ladies are serious devotees, that they want to make spiritual advancement, that they can understand Srila Prabhupada's books, that they want to help preach Krishna consciousness, maybe it'll be easier for them to develop a respectful attitude. Mm-hmm. And that respectful attitude will help them to conquer over this desire to lord it over and exploit.
Very good. Yeah, one more on this side. Then we have to wind it up. We're over time, huh? We have another session, so everybody can stew over all of this. And go ahead.
Well, you mentioned that tonight.
A little louder with me.
You mentioned that in our tradition there are women gurus, and I was wondering what the position is with the GBC when it comes to this, because it seems something that they would have to make a decision about, and it seems that if there were women were gurus in our movement, it would help the whole issue a lot, that the men would respect the female devotees a lot more. Mm-hmm.
There is no GBC resolution that says a woman cannot be an initiating guru. There's a procedure that we have for people becoming initiating gurus in ISKCON. There's a whole series of qualifications. None of them have to do with sex. So far as I know, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. If there has to be a local council, 10 senior people get together and recommend this person, and the name has to be put to the GBC, and if 3 GBC people object, it goes back to the local council. I mean, there's a whole procedure that has to be followed. And I think that... it would be hard on Shastri grounds to pass a resolution that said women can't be gurus. That would be a little tough to do that.